Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Wednesday, March 25th, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I am Avi Wolfman Arendt.
Yes, what if the biggest truth tellers in America weren't politicians or journalists, but comedians? Today on Studio 2, we're diving into a history that starts with blackface and goes into the truth-telling of Richard Pryor and ends with cultural powerhouses like Dave Chappelle, a journey where laughter is more than just entertainment. PBS NewsHour co-anchor Jeff Bennett will be with us today. He also happens to be from South Jersey. He's going to help us unpack his new book called Black Out Loud. Avi and I got a chance to peruse and dig deep into this book, and we'll go back to vaudeville all the way up to the 90s, an era that Bennett says was the golden age of black comedy. So many huge names. Think about the shows. The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, oh, yeah. Martin, right? Living Single, all that use comedy to address social issues and make you think. So I'm really excited about today's show. And of course, we want to hear from you.
Yes.
Our question of the day, we're asking you to tell us about a comedian who influenced the way you think about society and explain to us how they did that, right? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our streamers on YouTube or Facebook, you can put your comments in the chat.
Already some very good nominations for a comedian influenced the way you think about society. I'm not going to say any of them yet. That's a tease, folks. But I'm excited to hear more. 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org.
Trio of news stories, obviously.
Let's get into it. Now, we know, Cherry, there's a lot of skepticism out there around AI data centers and local communities. We just did a whole show on it.
Yep.
But we're starting to now see some bills moving through local legislatures that attempt to counterbalance the perceived costs or risks associated with these so-called hyperscale data centers. So yesterday in Pennsylvania, the State House passed a bill that would require new data centers to pay for any extra energy costs they create. It also mandates they use a certain amount of renewable energy and that the companies contribute to a state fund for low-income ratepayers. And as you probably know, context, newer data centers are very, very energy intensive. So that's what the bill is trying to address. Similar bill this week in New Jersey that passed through their General Assembly. This bill would create a new payment structure for data centers, essentially preventing them from triggering cost increases for other consumers. And there's a similar bill in the NJ State Senate. So basically, to sum it all up, there's some activity now around regulating how data centers operate, especially when it comes to the costs they might generate for electricity usage.
So interesting. And by the way, Wired just reported that Senator Bernie Sanders is expected to introduce an AI safety bill in the U.S. Senate on Monday that would seek a moratorium on data center construction to give lawmakers a chance to deal with AI. But I thought it was so interesting, Avi, because we've been talking about these data centers since last summer.
Yep.
And I was like, I haven't seen lawmakers act this quickly. Like they popped into action. You're
Absolutely.
Seeing real bills, real solutions being floated. And, you know, when we're still talking about SEPTA year after year, how to do the funding, this is one of the first times in
a
long
point.
Time I've seen lawmakers actually come up with solutions and get things on the move.
Probably reflects pressure from voters. I mean, there's grassroots pressure on this issue. They're watching what's happening in local communities. But again, they're also walking a fine line because when you hear here's a quote, right? New Jersey Assemblyman David Bailey Jr. talking about that bill over in New Jersey, saying this is not an anti-data center bill. We want to be married to data centers. We want them to come here. This bill says you want to come here, pay for what you say you're going to do. Put your money where your mouth is. Clearly, a lot of the legislators are also worried about chasing away the data centers and having the companies go to other states where there are less restrictions.
Yeah.
Now, on one hand, a lot of the companies that are investing can probably afford, on some level, the extra cost. And they can't go anywhere, right?
Yeah.
That's a key part of, like, this whole power dynamic. Like, there are certain locations based on how the electrical grid is there or the water usage they would require. They can't just go anywhere. It doesn't mean they have to come to Pennsylvania or New Jersey. They have other options besides those two states. but it isn't like total freedom of movement.
And this is a bipartisan issue, though. They're getting this pushback all over the country, red states, blue states. Yeah. This is not a political thing. This is a people thing. And folks just want to make sure that these data centers, with everything moving so fast, doesn't damage the environment or, you know, you know, hurt communities.
Those data centers that power your computers, maybe even your glasses.
I know, that's right. Philadelphia courts announced that smart Meta AI eyeglasses with recording features will be banned from city courthouses. For those of you who may not know, there are smart glasses, some by Ray-Ban Meta, that have that allow the user to record video, audio, and interact with Meta's artificial intelligence from within the eyeglass frames, right? You can use them even to make calls, right? Those glasses will now be prohibited from Philadelphia courthouses, the buildings, and the offices as of Monday, March 30th. The ban also includes cell phones, cameras, and any other recording devices unless there's special permission. Those were kind of already banned.
Yeah, that was already banned.
But, you know, this sort of expands that. And anyone caught with those items will be asked to leave. And if you're caught taking photos or recording them surreptitiously, you will be expelled from the building and you could face criminal charges. The court administrator said in a statement that this ban is designed to maintain courtroom security and strengthen privacy protections for everyone involved in legal proceedings. And if you think about it, with criminal proceedings, there's an issue, right? They want to prevent jury and witness intimidation. It's unclear how exactly they'll enforce this because they look like regular glasses.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They look like
I don't know what they're going to do
on the street. Yeah.
But this is becoming a real issue. Meta, members of Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg's team, they just got reprimanded by a judge in California for wearing the smart Meta camera glasses to that big social media trial that's happening there. And the judge specifically said, you must delete all the footage if you did record something, and you cannot use facial recognition software to identify the jurors.
And look, here's the bigger issue, right? There are places like courtrooms that are supposed to be protected spaces in our society. As technology becomes further embedded in everything that we wear, it could be even, you know, a tiny little thing in your ear, right? I mean, that's the direction all this is headed, right? How do you create spaces that are free from that type of surveillance?
It's
difficult, right?
It's difficult. And and Meta and all the Ray-Ban, they were getting in trouble recently because people were using the glasses, recording in bathrooms, doing all sorts of things. Yeah. And this footage goes back to those folks someplace else, and they're able to see this stuff. They're seeing private things.
Yeah. No, this is one example of trying to police a problem that's clearly growing.
Yeah.
And I don't know how we get our hands around it, but at least in a courtroom setting, you've got some ability to set parameters and hopefully enforce.
So don't be surprised if they're like, can I see those frames?
Right.
You might be
confused. Why would you want to see my glasses? This is why.
Mm-hmm.
So to some happier news, baseball season is upon us. Hooray.
Yay. Go Phils.
Yesterday, Phillies owner John Middleton showed off some of the new upgrades at Citizens Bank Park, which is in the middle of a $600 million renovation. Now, there's been a lot of negative feedback about one particular change. The team sold the naming rights to a concession area that had been named after beloved Phillies announcer Harry Callis. A lot of people, understandably, upset about that. Anyways, while unveiling these broader renovations, Middleton made a pretty interesting comment about Citizens Bank Park, which opened in 2004. According to the Philadelphia Business Journal, Middleton said, quote, "There's no reason in my mind why this stadium shouldn't be operating in 100 years and operating really well." And I have to say, it was a refreshing comment to hear because we're in an era where sports owners seem to want like a new stadium every 30 years or so.
Yeah.
And here's an owner going on the record saying, I want this thing to last. I want this thing to, you know, become an icon of the Philadelphia region. We'll see if they pull it off. But I liked to hear that. I thought that was really, like I said, refreshing and new and shows some vision beyond just making as much money as possible.
Yeah, I kind of like that too. I mean, because you kind of grow to like a place, right? And it brings back nostalgia and memories, and it links generations. And
exactly.
So why not try to make your building iconic and have
be
it
the
stick
steward
around?
Of that. Be the steward of that history. And I think there's always the sort of the trouble period for stadiums between like age 30 and 60 where it's old but not yet iconic, mm-hmm. and people want to scrap them then. But if you can push through that, you can push become through. Like a Fenway Park or a Wrigley Field, and it can become, like you said, really special to people.
Yeah, do and some renovations. We're not saying don't upgrade, but absolutely. Yeah.
And I would say so far, Citizens Bank Park has aged really well. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably the best major sort of sports venue.
For sure. And it works well as a concert venue. I saw Beyonce perform there. I mean, it was great. And it brings people together. Like you said, it brings people together.
It becomes part of the fabric
of
the city.
Exactly. And stick around, Citizens Bank Park. I'd like to see you, years from now.
Yeah, we're not going to make it to 100. But whatever.
We might. You know.
With advances in modern science, with our Meta glasses. Anyways. By the way, the Palestra turns 100 on February 1st, 1927. So it could be the next Palestra. We're going to talk about comedy on the other side of this break. Don't go anywhere. Studio 2. Bye.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Martin, the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, Living Single in Living Color. They're just a few of the shows from the 1990s boom in black-centered television. In a new book, PBS NewsHour co-anchor Jeff Bennett argues this was a golden era of TV, which for the first time offered full and varied depictions of black life on the small screen. His new book is Black Out Loud, The Revolutionary History of Black Comedy from Vaudeville to 90s Sitcoms.
Bennett, a South Jersey native, explores how performers like Moms Mabley, Hattie McDaniel, Red Fox, Richard Pryor, Dave Chappelle, and many others pushed social change, subversively challenged racial stereotypes, all while keeping their audiences, both black and white, laughing through it all. Jeff Bennett joins us now. Jeff, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be with you.
It's great to have you, and it's great to have our audience with us. We have a prompt for you today. We want you to tell us about a comedian who influenced the way you think about society and why. Don't just give a name. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. If you're streaming on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
And so, Jeff, so great to have you here. First of all, congratulations on the book.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
308 pages. So I got to ask you, what was it about black comedy that interested you so much that you wanted to write a book about it?
It's a great question. Thank you. And frankly, Jerry, it's the question I got the most when I was pitching this book to publishing houses, because the response was, you cover national politics.
Yes.
Why not write a book about politics? Why not write a book about Joe Biden or Donald Trump or any one of the past presidents? And my response was, politics is already so all-consuming. It really just works its way into every aspect of American life. And I knew that if I was going to write a book, it's the thing that you are thinking about when you wake up. It's the thing that you are fretting about when you go to sleep. It just really just works its way into your brain. And I have enough political coverage in my brain already. But the thing I had really wondered about growing up, I grew up in Voorhees, New Jersey, South Jersey, just across the river from y'all. Mm-hmm. I'd wondered about growing up, what was it about the 1990s where you had all of these different shows on the air at one time? And the fact that they were on the air simultaneously mattered, because it meant that you had all of these different visions and versions of black life, so that no one sitcom bore the burden of representing the entirety of the black experience. And when I say that, I'm using air quotes, because there is no such thing as the as one single monolithic black experience. So you had an affluent family on Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. You had four friends, four young up-and-coming professional women on Living Single. You had the creative hijinks of a Martin Lawrence. You had In Living Color. We'll talk about how all of this started really in Living Color. In Late Night, you had Arsenio, king of late night, as far as I'm concerned, culturally. And that's just television. In the 90s, 90s R&B, unmatched. 90s film, Eddie Murphy, Will Smith, early, you know, into the early 2000s, they were the top of the box office. So just across almost every aspect of cultural creation, you had black creatives at the forefront of it. I work in television. I was focused on television. And that's really what was the genesis of this book. But I approached this with the instincts of a journalist, the heart of a fan. I realized you could not tell the story of the 90s responsibly without tracking back to the beginning of comedic performance, black comedic performance in this country, which is vaudeville. So the book starts there and works its way up to the golden age of sitcom television, which was the 1990s.
Yeah.
So you write in the book that the evolution of black humor in America is at its core a study in comfort. How freely can black comedians reveal their true selves on stage? And like you said, you start with the vaudeville where the answer is they can reveal almost none of their true selves on stage. In fact, black performers are often wearing black face. So let's go back to kind of the what you say the first black entertainer to achieve national celebrity, a person named Billy Kersands, and what you took away from his story.
Yeah, so Billy Kersands, and we should remember, minstrelsy was mass entertainment of its day. It was sort of like reality television is now. And for the black performers who had a calling to be on stage, all they could do was put on blackface and mock blackness, whatever that meant. So exaggerated stereotypes. And so what Billy Kersands and Burt Williams and others sought to do was, so much as they were able, try to infuse some sense of dignity, some sense of humanity into those performances. And so one of the reasons why the book is called Black Out Loud, it's a play on Laugh Out Loud. What it speaks to is that from the beginnings of minstrelsy, vaudeville, and working with our way up to the 90s, what you see is black performers working outside of other people's expectations and working inside their own, out loud and in full color. And so the DNA of black comedy really starts with Burt Williams, Billy Kersands, Moms Mabley, and then it extends, of course, over the years to folks like Richard Pryor, Eddie Murphy, so on and so on.
And I think about it as it's almost like they were code switching in a lot of ways, because you talk about in the book how a lot of early black performers did not give white audiences specifically the type of things that they would laugh, that black communities would laugh about amongst themselves. They had a different persona. So was this, could you talk about this idea of code switching on stage and how it kind of through time became more code breaking because they sort of broke out of that?
That's such a great way to put it, Cherry. And we know that too from the enslaved folks, that comedy and humor was really a survival tactic and it had a subversive element to it. Avi, you asked about Kersands and Burt Williams. Burt Williams has a quote where he said, "It's no disgrace to be a Negro, but it is very inconvenient." And you can see that tension, to your question, Cherry. You can see that tension in his work, the push and pull between who he was and who he was allowed to show. And that's where you get that code switching element. He's talking to white audiences in one way, but black folks who were watching it could pick up on certain elements of his performance that were speaking to them directly.
We're asking you this hour to tell us about a comedian who influenced the way you think about society. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're streaming on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat. Toure, who, by the way, is a stand-up comedian, says, "Richard Pryor, his ability to bring us to his world and make us understand why this is humor was uncanny." Still sort of working our way up to Richard Pryor. I would love to get into some of like the pivot points, so some of the bridges between that early era of vaudeville and minstrelsy into what eventually becomes the Richard Pryor era. And one person you focus on is Hattie McDaniel, who is probably best known for being in the 1940 film Gone with the Wind. She won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress for her role as Mammy. It was the first time a black actor won an Academy Award. And let's hear a clip from her performance in that film.
And how come you didn't ask them gentlemen to stay for supper? You ain't got no more manners than a field hand. After me, Miss Ellen done labored with you.
Miss Carter?
Come on in the house. Come on in before you catch your death of dampness.
No, I'm going to wait for Paul to come home from the Wilkes'.
Come on in here. Come on.
So Hattie McDaniel, how did she help sort of move the art form, move comedy forward? Because a lot of people know her for that particular role. They might not really know her background and her backstory in the entertainment business. I'd love for you to get into that as well, but also like what about this was groundbreaking at the time?
And we should say, watching that clip, listening to that clip can be uncomfortable for people, given that she was playing a stereotype. But one of the things with this book I sought to do was to look at these performers and apply a lens on these performers that was applicable to the times in which they were working. And so Hattie McDaniel's story is one of breakthrough and burden. You mentioned that she was the first black person to win an Academy Award back in 1940. Historic moment, but obviously she was sitting at a segregated table and she couldn't go to the film's premiere in Atlanta because of segregation. And then she had to deal with the criticism, the black community at the time, who felt that her role reinforced stereotypes. And she famously said, "I'd rather play a maid than be one." Because in that era, those were the roles that were available to her. And like the minstrels that we talked about earlier, that role that she played in Gone with the Wind, even there, I mean, she was infusing a level of humanity and dignity into that role, even as she was playing a stereotype. She brought depth and presence to her character work. Before she was a film star, as is true for many of these folks, she was a radio star. She was the first black woman to host her own radio show. So her story really reminds us, and the reason she's in the book is that she reminds us that like representation is rarely simple, that progress does not come in a straight line. It comes with trade-offs, it comes with debate, and so many of these performers are trying to make the best decision, the best choice for themselves that they can make in the moment. And that's certainly reflected in the book.
And she certainly saw herself. She even said that she took her role in Hollywood as an opportunity to glorify black womanhood. And of course, looking back, right, you look back in that role and you're trying to understand, so how was this glorification? And I guess you kind of need to understand what came before it, Jeff, to see how she could have viewed this as glorification, rightly so. I mean, what was she building off of that was but that made what she was doing different, distinct, and more humanizing.
What was she building off of? I mean, she was building off of a legacy of black performance that, again, was so deep and rich. She was the first, she was the only. So in some ways, she was basically laying the foundation for herself, which all, she also deserves credit for that. And that is also the story of black comedy in this country. You have these trailblazers who kick the door open and in varying ways hold the door open just wide enough, just long enough for other people to walk through it. And so that was certainly the case with, Philly's own Quinta Brunson, Abbott Elementary. When she got that show, who does she turn to for advice? Larry Wilmore, who got his start in the writer's room of In Living Color. And Larry Wilmore also helped Issa Rae develop Insecure. So you see that just from modern times to the really beginnings of black comedy in this country.
Yeah, I want to bring in a caller. We have Maria from Morristown, New Jersey on the line. Maria, you're on Studio Two. What's your question or comment?
Hi, I just wanted to throw Anthony Anderson and Black-ish into the discussion because it's such a great show in that it shows how, a modern day upper class family of color is still dealing with racism. And I've caught myself at times like laughing at things, they're making jokes and I'm like, oh, that's right. White people can be that way. And that's, it really gets me to think, the humor gets me to think about issues that they're facing in a way that isn't off-putting. It's like, yeah, that's right. And I really admire him taking on the issues that he did in the show.
Thank you so much. That's Maria from Morristown, New Jersey, highlighting Black-ish and Anthony Anderson. By the way, tell us about a comedian who influenced the way you think about society. The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're streaming on YouTube or Facebook, you can keep those comments coming in the chat. Jeff, I will tell you, Sammy Davis Jr., you talked about how he was another bridge. He brought, a skit from a comedian that a lot of folks may not have heard of called Pigmeek Markham. And he brought it into mainstream television to in front of primarily white audiences. We have a clip of that. Sammy Davis Jr., Here Comes a Judge sketch in 1970 from the TV show Rowan and Martin's Laughing. Take a look, listen.
Swear to tell the truth and you better come clean, cause here come the judge and he look mighty mean. Here come the judge. Here come the judge. Here come the judge.
Gentlemen of the jury, the defendant has been charged with stealing a horse. How do you find him?
Why don't you try following the tracks, Judge?
And this was another, and reading your book, another pivot point in Black comedy, where you saw Black comedians not just being on stage, but like they're on mainstream television with mainstream audiences. How important was it for a comedian like Sammy Davis Jr. to build that bridge and bring in some comedy that used to be on stage to a majority audience to the next generation that came in the later 70s?
Yeah, you take the tradition of Black comedy and you scale it. And that's what we saw there. That Here Comes the Judge routine. It had become a hit record. Suddenly it becomes a part of the national dialogue. And so you can draw a line from that to what you kind of see in on the show like Laugh-In, let's say. So it was hugely, hugely important on a cultural level. If I kind of want to go back to what our caller friend, I think her name was Maria, said about Black-ish, because that is such an important point. These shows, the shows I cover in the book, I don't cover Black-ish because it was extended
2000s.
Beyond the 90s.
Yeah, 2000s. Yeah.
But for the reason these shows were important in the 90s was that they operated on two levels. For Black folks watching them, they were a mirror. You were seeing yourself reflected in a way that was specific and true. For everybody else, they were a window. They were a window into experiences and lives that and jokes that you might not otherwise have encountered. And I think, Avi, in the introduction, you referred to these sitcoms as Black-centered, and that's certainly true. But because they were so specific and authentic, they had universal appeal. There were tens of millions of people who watched these shows across race, across region, across background. And so, you know, Cosby Show was number one for decades. A Different World was number two. Cheers was number three. I interviewed Barry Diller for this book. He created Fox Broadcasting Network. And he told me that when he launched Fox Broadcasting Network, he looked across the landscape of primetime television, sitcoms, and realized that what ABC, CBS, and NBC were putting on the air were basically indistinguishable. And he knew that Fox had to skew younger, it had to be bold, and it had to be urban. And so the first pilot that he got was for a show called Not the Cosby Show, because word had gone out in Hollywood that they wanted something that was a little countercultural. And that's how on the nose it was, Not the Cosby Show. That show later became Married with Children. And when Married with Children found success, that spelled the formula for everything else. So you get The Simpsons, you get Cops, remember that show? You then get Kenan Ivory Wayans, who gets the green light and the access and the agency and the funding to basically put his entire family on TV. And because the pipeline for sketch comedy at that time was really built around Saturday Night Live, Kenan Ivory Wayans had to go out and find all of these funny people, people who we now know, like David Alan Greer and Jamie Foxx and Jim Carrey. And then don't forget Rosie Perez and Carrie Ananaba and Jennifer Lopez, who were the Fly Girls. So these shows, they had to operate, they had to be funny at the end of the day. They had to be the thing that they had to be engaging and resonant. Yeah. People had to tune in week after week. So they operated on that level. But the reason that they were culturally important is because tens of millions of people were watching them and having the same conversation, the same reference point week after week.
And I want to jump in here because these were shows, and the reason why I was so fascinated with the history of this is because earlier you had shows with Black people in them that were not created by Black people necessarily, but the 90s represented an era of Black creators. How did the storyline shift? Because you talk about just what people were referring to, just the types of jokes, just who was behind the scenes. All of that shifted in the 90s, which makes it, I think, fundamentally different from earlier eras in Black comedy.
Yeah, there had certainly been Black folks on TV well before the 90s. I mean, there was Good Times, there was Sanford and Son. But to your point, a couple of those shows were developed by Norman Lear, who was brilliant, but he was not Black and did not come from the Black experience and was not representing that on television. And so that's what's so fundamentally different. You had showrunners, you had performers, obviously, and producers who were young, who happened to be Black or brown of color, and they were writing from what they knew, and that was showing up on screen. And so take a show like Living Single, for instance. Yvette Lee Bowser, who created that show, I interviewed her as well. She started in the writer's room of A Different World in the second season when Debbie Allen came in and basically overhauled that show. And Queen Latifah and Kim Coles had a development deal that really didn't go anywhere. They kept getting paired with writers who didn't really understand them, and they were giving them scripts that didn't work. And Yvette Lee Bowser was paired with them and said, I have this idea for this show of four women living in Brooklyn. They're all sort of figuring it out, but a couple of them have high-powered careers. And this is the show. And that's now what became Living Single.
Mm-hmm.
That show was important for a number of reasons. It created the ensemble blueprint that leads to Friends. And that's not me saying that. That's folks connected to Friends and folks connected to Living Single telling me that. And there was a character on that show named Maxine Shaw, Maxine Shaw, attorney at law. There is now a whole lane of academic research that speaks about the numbers of women who were encouraged to go into high-powered professions because they saw that Maxine Shaw character do it first. So these shows allow people to play out in their mind's eye, what would it be like if I went to an HBCU, as in the case of A Different World? Or what would it be like if I decided to become a lawyer, as in the case of Living Single?
But I
so
even think
Kamala Harris and Stacey Abrams and all sorts of members of Congress who happen to be African-American women have told Erica Alexander that they were in some way inspired by her. It's hugely important.
And by the way, I think that there's a connection to Girlfriends, which also led to Sex and the City. Like a lot of shows with four single women sort of living their life. And I think back to Living Single and how that led to a lot of different shows. Yeah.
Yeah. And Erica Alexander from Philadelphia,
by
so
the way.
That's right. You know, it's funny. When I was interviewing her, she mentioned her time at Freedom Theater, and a light just went off in my head because I hadn't heard of Freedom Theater in decades. But yeah, it's
Leslie Odom was trained there, too. A lot of folks.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I want to bring in another caller before we get to a break because you mentioned Norman Lear, and I think our caller is going to mention a Norman Lear-created show. This is Jacques from Devon on the line. Jacques, you're on Studio 2. Would love to hear your perspective.
Thanks for taking the call. It's a fascinating show. I'm interested in the journey that you're tracing. I'd like to hear you talk about the significance of All in the Family, of Archie Bunker, the influence that he had in this whole journey. I mean, he held up a mirror that, it was so significant that I remember the network actually put a disclaimer on the air before the show began.
Mm. Thank you so much. That's Jacques from Devon. I'm curious for your thoughts because it's actually not a huge part of the book, Jeff. The Jeffersons is mentioned, Good Times mentioned, but like they're not getting their own chapters in this book.
And I explained why. It's because they're not creative products of Black performers and Black producers. But to the caller's great question, you know, Norman Lear and Archie Bunker. That there's a direct line between the work that Red Fox did on that show. And you would not have a Red Fox, you wouldn't have a Sanford and Son were it not for Archie Bunker. But Archie Bunker was playing out a number of these political debates in a way on television that had never happened before. And this is another thing I play with in the book, the different speeds at which politics and culture move. As we've seen with just the way that, you know, DEI and affirmative action policy have been rolled back lately, you know, politics is important because it creates a structure for things to happen in this country.
Yep.
But as we've seen, politics has a way of being unwound depending on whoever happens to win the election. There is a durability to cultural change that I think is important and is reflective of some study. And I did that in the book. And you see that first with a show like All in the Family, with some of the conversations that Archie Bunker was having and the way his younger children would look at him as some sort of, you know, old washed up guy who had super conservative, out of mode ideas. And you see that playing in real time. And what it allows folks watching it to do is to think about how that shows up in their own lives. So that show was important on that level. And then you see the progression of that in some of the sitcoms that come on later.
Yeah.
Well, we've got a lot of comments rolling in, folks shouting out the comedians that made them look at the world differently. Eric, who says he once hosted Paul Mooney, says, quote, Mooney's raw, unapologetic style of telling truth through humor was inspiring. Greg agrees. One of the absolute key personalities in American Black comedy was Paul Mooney, a performer and writer frequently partnered with Richard Pryor. Later in his career, he was also featured on The Chappelle Show, which we'll get to on the other side of this break.
And we got to talk about Pryor a little bit. Pivot point, another pivot point in this evolution of Black comedy. Our question for you today is, tell us about a comedian who influenced the way you think about society. The number is 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We are talking with PBS NewsHour co-anchor Jeff Bennett about his new book, Black Out Loud, The Revolutionary History of Black Comedy from Vaudeville to 90s Sitcoms. It explores the evolution and impact of black comedians and black-centered television shows.
Yes, and we want to hear from you, our listeners. Tell us about a comedian who influenced the way you think about society. The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our YouTubers and Facebookers, you can drop a comment in the chat. Boyd Photography on YouTube says black comedy is rooted in pain. And although he was known for his writing, Paul Moody was able to edutain through stories and jokes about the black experience in America. And I mentioned before the break, Jeff, that I wanted to talk about Richard Pryor. I want to play a clip because here's Richard Pryor from his first TV appearance, in 1964. Take a look.
Well, if you're lucky enough to get a cab, you get in and say, driver, I want to go to 78th Street. Driver says, I'm not going that way. What do you mean? I want to go to 78th Street. You're going to give me a tip? I'm going to tip your cab over. You don't take me to 78th Street.
And so I think about Richard Pryor, so many comedians who really came of age in the 80s and 90s and kind of even, Dave Chappelle, they point to Richard Pryor as a major pivot point in black comedy. And you heard there, he's telling a joke about a reality that black people were dealing with, right? Could not get a cab, but he's feeding it to the audience with a spoonful of sugar, that joke. Can you talk about sort of this edutainment that we saw that one of our Facebookers or YouTubers talked about, and how comedy was used to sort of educate people post-civil rights movement?
It's such a great point, that edutainment. And shout out to your producer for finding all these amazing clips. It's not easy to do.
Oh, yeah.
But they're terrific.
The clean they're Richard amazing. Pryor ones, there's like, that
you
was the
sift.
One.
You got to dig.
That was the only
one. No, totally. Richard Pryor is a turning point. I mean, before Pryor, a lot of comedy, especially mainstream comedy, was all about fitting in. It was about appealing broadly. Pryor initially started as a clean comic because he was inspired by Bill Cosby. But as he found his voice, he really flips it. He goes inward. He starts telling the truth. And in doing that, he changes everything. He really just kicks the hinges off of the doors of comedy. His comedy is raw. It's vulnerable. He talks about race, addiction, poverty, police encounters. And what made him revolutionary, well beyond the years of that clip that we saw, as you mentioned, that was the beginning of his career, is that he doesn't perform a version of himself for the audience's comfort. He insisted on being fully himself. And to say that now, it's like, well, what's the big deal? Every comic is like that. I mean, we sort of prize authenticity. But that wasn't the case back then. And there's this famous real shift in his career, again, where he moves away from this polished, traditional style into something more personal. And of course, as you all both know, you can draw a direct line between the work that an Eddie Murphy, a Chris Rock, a Dave Chappelle does, and what Richard Pryor did toward the end of his career. Yeah.
And you say that there was this internal battle through Pryor's whole career, how much of private black life and private black thoughts should be shared with white people. If we reveal too much, will they reject us? Will they be horrified or frightened? And he's always bumping up against that. Obviously, he's tremendously popular, Richard Pryor. But then he also tries to create his own television show, The Richard Pryor Show. It lasts like 4 episodes,
I was shocked
think.
By that, yeah.
And I believe in Philadelphia, there was a couple markets, including Philadelphia, where they would not show it in primetime. I think they aired it at like 11 o'clock. And of course, like that's because he's pushing so far. And later, did the people that came after Pryor, do you feel like some of them sort of pulled it back a little bit to make sure it got to the broadest audience? Did they keep pushing further? Like, what was the push-pull after Pryor, knowing that he did come up against some limitations?
Yeah, Richard Pryor was a live wire. I mean, it was largely influenced by the addiction, his addiction battle. The thing that you see with later comics, and this is true of a Kevin Hart for sure, is a respect of the business side of show business. It's one thing to have a show. It's a completely different thing to keep it. And to have a show that lasts only four episodes on the air, it really speaks to an inability to understand the business side of this and to be a reliable business partner for the studio. And that's what's so great about the 90s, is that whether it was Keenan Ivory Wayans or Queen Latifah or any of the folks on A Different World, Arsenio, who was an incredible businessman. I didn't know until doing this book that Arsenio effectively owned his late night show. The lesson from Pryor was you have to understand how the business works. You have to understand who cuts your check every week, and you have to understand what it means to keep them happy so you can stay on the air and so you can keep doing this work.
Yeah. And I got to act because, and I know a lot of folks feel uncomfortable talking about Bill Cosby, Philadelphia native, who's had been disgraced over the past few years. But I can't not talk about the Cosby Show and Bill Cosby as a comedian, because one of the things you point out in your book, the Cosby Show rescued NBC, and it showed that Black sitcoms and Black shows could make a lot of money. And when you talk about this opened the door to the 90s. All of these Black shows being on air at the same time, can you, and that white audiences would accept a Black show, and a Black show could be number one on air. Can you talk about the significance of that and Black shows equaling profitable as a major turning point?
And Bill Cosby's work starts with, in television anyway, I Spy.
Goes all the way back.
Here's the thing about Bill Cosby, and this is what I grappled with in the book. To talk about Bill Cosby, you have to hold two truths at once.
Yeah.
The Cosby Show was vital. It was key to television, period. Certainly this period in the book I talk about, which was the 90s, 90s Black sitcoms. But what he is accused of, what he served time for, is monstrous.
Yes.
Absolutely. Full stop. And so you have to grapple with those things. You have to reckon with those things simultaneously. And so for the book, I had to separate the art from the man. Because, again, I couldn't tell the story of these shows, and I couldn't tell the story of the Cosby Show without looking at the art itself. And to your point, Cherry, I mean, yes, to have that show be number one for as long as it was just so, it was foundational, and it was so important. And it wasn't just that they were an upper-class Black family showing the universality of that experience. It was that he was also infusing Black art. Think of all the art that was on the walls.
Jazz.
In that Brooklyn brownstone. And the jazz. Remember when Heathcliff Huxtable would go to the jazz club and he'd have on these jazz artists and stuff on the show, and Nancy Wilson was on that program. You know, I remember coming up and realizing that, oh, Nancy Wilson is a jazz singer? I thought she was an actress on The Cosby Show. So there are different entry points for people into that experience. There would not be a Secretary of State Colin Powell. There would not be a President Barack Obama if it were not for The Cosby Show. And if there were, it would not have happened as quickly. Mm. And that gets to the point I made earlier about the importance, the importance of the durability of cultural change in this country. Politics matters. You can have all sorts of policies to do whatever you want. Policy matters. Of course it does. But there's something to be said about the softening the distance between people and people finding familiarity among each other when they sit down in their living rooms with their families and watch these shows every week, night after night, for years.
Yeah, got to point out, Erica.
It started in that era with The Cosby Show.
And Erica Alexander, who we talked about from Living Single, she was Cousin Pam on that show. Like
a lot of people
got that their careers launched because of that show. Yeah.
Yes,
and look, and Cosby's such an interesting contrast with Richard Pryor. As you said, Richard Pryor initially kind of wanted to be like a Bill Cosby, then took a different path. But you had this quote about Cosby from a critic from 1965, and I think this is the I Spy era, and it's saying about Cosby, his presence is merely taken for granted, and thereby more is achieved for better racial relations than by 1,000 propaganda exhortations. I think that was from a writer named Ben Gross. And it goes to like sort of the idea of if your goal, and Cosby did have this goal, of trying to advance racial relations and racial equity in this country, is it more important to just be visible, or is it more important to use your visibility to make a point or a sharper point than perhaps Cosby was making? How did you see that tension playing out through this whole history in the book?
That's a great question, Avi. Thank you. Well, in this book, Black Out Loud, I think both are true. I mean, there's something to be said about people don't want to be lectured to. I think that was the other lesson of the last election, is that people don't want to be lectured to. People were not tuning into these shows for civic education. Mm-hmm. They were tuning into these shows to laugh. And there's something that was gleaned by laughing together. There is a cultural cohesion. There's a social cohesion by people just sharing a laugh and seeing other people as just like yourself, because your defenses are down and you're just trying to relax, watch a show, that sort of thing. So the visibility just in and of itself matters. And I would argue that if early days Bill Cosby, given the significant cultural role that he had, if he had come across as some sort of scold, or if he had come across as some sort of, I don't know, you know, sword-waving freedom fighter, that would have undermined the work that he did. Mm. But it wasn't as if he existed in a vacuum, because as he was doing his work, you did have people on the front lines of the civil rights fight.
Dick Gregory, yeah.
Exactly. Well, not even just Dick Gregory. I mean, you had all sorts of, you had Medgar Evers and Martin Luther King Jr., of course, and like Malcolm X. You had civil rights figures who were on the front lines, marching, getting beaten, getting hosed down by fire hoses, who were going to Capitol Hill, who were pressing that case. And that was vitally important. At the same time, though, you had those cultural figures like a Dick Gregory, and early days Bill Cosby and Harry Belafonte, and the list goes on, who are working in concert on parallel tracks to push this country forward. And in so doing, really opened up the American imagination.
Yeah. And I know 90s was a big, love fest focus for you in this book. And so I got to talk about In Living Color, because that came out in the early 90s. And it's a show that brought together all sorts of really funny people of color and really changed culture. And I want to play a clip from that. Here's Damon Wayans playing Homie D. Clown, a disgruntled prison hardened clown who refuses to act like a fool for laughs and uses the catchphrase, "Homie, don't play that." Unforgettable. Take a look. Listen.
All right, kids, I'm Homie the Clown. Y'all ready to have some fun?
Yeah!
All right, what y'all want me to do first?
Ooh. Homie, y'all do a silly clown dance for us.
Oh. Yeah! Degrade myself, huh? I don't think so. Homie, don't play that. Bust my skull open, have my blood and brains ooze out on the carpet so you can get a couple of cheap laughs, huh? I don't think so. Homie, don't play that.
And I love that clip in part because, you know, we're at a point, if you fast forward in Black comedy history, where folks don't, the whole culture has changed around Black comedy, and folks, they keep it real. They're telling truths. You see Dave Chappelle come out. He's smoking a cigarette. I mean, telling hard truths. Can you talk about In Living Color a little bit, but also just sort of how we got to this place where you see so many different Black comedians and so many people able to be their full selves on stage and have a very mixed audience?
Yeah, David Alan Greer made the point that you could not have a show like In Living Color on the air these days, in part because if people were offended by what they saw, not by that clip, but there were some other really boundary-pushing sketches on that show, they would have to write a letter. And back then, first of all, good luck finding what address to send it to. And by the time that they would receive the letters at the network, they'd already been done filming for the season. But that show was so wild because it really was a business decision. Again, it was Barry Diller saying, "We're trying to differentiate and we're ready to take risks. And, you know, we had success with these sort of subversive shows. So we're just going to keep going in that direction." And so, you know, Keenan Ivory Wayans had come off of "I'm Going to Get You, Sucka," and had a real, really like firmly defined image in his mind of what that show should be. He had said that his writer's room was not a democracy. It was a dictatorship. He had grown up in a very funny family. So anything that got on the air had to make him laugh first. The second season of In Living Color is unmatched. Every sketch on that show for that entire season was brilliant, to include all of the musical acts. That was the other thing about In Living Color was the musical act. I remember I grew up in Voorhees, went to Voorhees Middle School, and the day after Criss Cross was on that show, all these kids come in, and this was a diverse middle school, all these kids come in with their clothes on backwards because they had seen Criss Cross perform the previous night on In Living Color doing Jump Jump with their clothes on backwards. So it was that kind of thing. Everybody was watching it. Everybody was talking about it. And that show also revolutionized the Super Bowl halftime show. Before 1992, the Super Bowl halftime show was a fairly run-of-the-mill affair. CBS at the time had the Super Bowl, and they would use the halftime show to promote whatever else they had on. So they were promoting the Winter Olympics. So it was a marching band. It was Brian Boitano. And Living Color decides, we're going to counter-program. So what they do is they come up with a 20-minute condensed version of their show. You can see this on YouTube now. And Jim Carrey at the start says, we're going to put a clock at the bottom. It's going to be about 15, 20 minutes. You're not going to miss the game. Yeah. Just stay with us and watch this show. They siphoned off more than 20 million people from CBS over to Fox. Most people did not switch back over to CBS. The very next year, the NFL and CBS book Michael Jackson because they say, we can't have this happen again. And that's how you get the spectacle of the Super Bowl halftime show.
And it's this interesting moment where there is competition introduced, but still a monoculture hanging on. That great convergence happens in the early 90s. And thank you so much for this book, Jeff Bennett, co-anchor of PBS NewsHour. The book that I just mentioned is called Black Out Loud, The Revolutionary History of Black Comedy from Vaudeville to 90s Sitcoms. Jeff, thanks for sitting with us this hour.
Thanks for the great conversation. I appreciate you both.
Yes, and sorry to Richard from Medford, New Jersey, who was on the lines. Richard, so sorry we couldn't get to you today. But thanks to the callers we were able to get in and to everybody who commented on Facebook and emailed in. Our show, of course, is produced by Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel Mae Bryan. The show was engineered by Al Banks and Mike Schiffler, who is also our visual producer. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory from Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk to you tomorrow.